This week on Focus on Photography, we sit down with Fujifilm ambassador Brian Manier, and we also take a look at what's going on with Adobe Lightroom's competitor, Capture One. Check it out.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Focus on Photography, episode 6, recorded Thursday, December 5th, 2019. The Next Jedi. Hey folks, I'm Matt Pruitt. This is Focus on Photography here on TWiT.tv. Thank y'all for hopping in. Thank you to our wonderful chat room for joining us on live.twit.tv each and every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific and watching us live as we go through and talk about the latest and greatest in the photography-related news and rumor world and sometimes flub and mess up here on the camera, but it's all good. It's all fun. And then we also like to sit down and talk about just everyday, regular, day-to-day stuff in life of a working photographer or videographer or graphic designer or creative artist, whatever it is, you name it, we're going to sit and chit chat about it. Now, this week, I don't have my man Wools joining me. He's out doing a client job this morning. More power to him on that, but we'll get you next week, Mr. Woolsey, and I will give you some grief about that. Don't you worry. But we also have an esteemed guest, my man, Mr. Brian Manier, an outstanding graphics artist, outstanding photographer on all levels, not just digital, but we talking film and the whole nine. Mr. Brian, how you doing, brother?
That was quite the introduction. I'm great, man. Thanks. I'm honored to be here.
Sweet. I really do appreciate you joining us and hopping in with us this week. We're going to get into some of the stuff that you've been doing and working on here a little bit later on in the show, but first and foremost, because this is a technology network here, technology podcast network, so I'm going to go through and knock out some of the interesting stories and rumors and stuff, because nerds like that stuff, right?
Yep.
Right. Okay. All right, so let's go ahead and get started with the first couple of rumors. First and foremost, Sony has now taken the lead over Nikon and over Canon with regards to sales of full-frame cameras. It's been a full year, and now they have taken the lead with like a 38% market share versus everybody else being around 30% or so. But there is one small detail. That's only in Japan. It's not worldwide. This bit of news showed up on F-Stoppers as well as BCN, a Japanese network out there that handles news and photography related content. This is pretty big news in my opinion. It just shows that Sony is continuing to do a good job, but it's still not global, but that's still pretty big. Now, when I thought more about it, I started to consider, okay, full frame cameras. Sony has quite a bit out there, so that makes it a little bit easier. And it also have quite a bit of older models that you can still grab right now and use and get pretty good content from them. What do you think, Brian?
You're talking to a Fujifilm ambassador, so no comment.
No comment. That's right. Yeah, we're going to get to that too. But yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting news. I'm curious to see what's going to happen with it, you know, from a global standpoint, just because, again, they have such a huge line of different mm-hmm. products that are out there, whether it's the super expensive A9 line, or you can go all the way down to the first couple of iterations of their A7 line or A7s or A7Rs, all the way back to the very first iterations that you could still get pretty good quality content.
I think
for.
If I could chime in on anything, yep. like, and one of the things that I noticed early on, gosh, this must have been, I don't know when, I've never really followed Sony as it pertains to cameras. Like, I was a Canon shooter before I switched to Fujifilm.
Yep.
But when Sony kind of started, you know, the Alpha series of cameras and they started popping up, I had more and more friends jumping from Canon to Sony mm-hmm. only because of the Metabones adapter that lets you just adapt the Canon glass that you already have. So they, right. it was essentially like Canon wasn't innovating at the rate that a lot of photographers wanted, and Sony was kind of that escape for them. So I think Sony really jumped out early in that market solely because, I mean, I can't even count the number of friends that I had that shot Canon that switched to Sony and never even owned a Sony lens, you know?
You said one phrase there that I still continue to hear. Canon not innovating fast enough. You know, and I'm a Canon guy. I still mm-hmm. like Canon because I like Canon lenses. And mm-hmm. They seem to be a pretty strong standard out there. But I can't deny the talks that you hear from the photography community that, you know, whatever Sony is doing, they're doing it at a faster rate and they're doing a really good job at it. They've had their issues in the early stages of it back in, say, 2012, 2013. But when you look right now, you know, 6-7 years later, they're doing pretty daggum good with what mm-hmm. they've learned over those years. So I got to give them yep. credit. And Canon I'm sure Canon is trying to catch up. We have a couple yep. of different rumors and things in there from Canon. They're trying to catch up, but we'll have to see. We'll have to see going forward. Speaking of Canon, allegedly, according to Canon rumors and Petapixel, Canon is working on a pro body-ish on the mirrorless side of things. When you're speaking of mirrorless, you're speaking of the EOS R, and you're speaking of the EOS RP. The EOS R is more of the upper echelon from a feature standpoint. And I remember when that camera came out, it got a ton of negative press, negative reviews. Nobody liked it. But, of course, you start to update firmware, everybody jumps back on the bandwagon and talks about how much they enjoy it and what it feels like, yada, yada, yada. But they always said, hey, we need this to be a pro body, something for the pros out there. We need dual card slots. We need this feature and that feature. And according to these rumor reveals, Canon is working on that by adding a EF and RF hybrid mount for the lens systems, as well as they're moving into an ultra megapixel design where you have like the 5 DSR on the DSLR side. We're going to have a similar variant, supposedly, on the mirrorless side. I believe it when I see it, but it is about time for something like that from Canon because it's been a couple of years and it's time to, you know, build upon all of this investment that you're making on the mirrorless side if you want to continue to compete with the likes of Sony on the mirrorless side. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I just think they're playing catch up right now and, I don't know. I think they're definitely working hard. And I think the stuff, I mean, in my like personal, I'm at a point in my career where I'm not really chasing the specs anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of settled in with the cameras that I use. I've realized I really don't need full frame for what I do. But I mean, I'm definitely I just feel like anytime you see the market innovating like this, it's nothing but good for all parties involved.
I was giving my boss, Mr. Leo Laporte, a hard time yesterday because, you know, you mentioned chasing specs. And a lot of people in the photography standpoint, when they're getting started, they start to look at the spec sheet and they try to compare spec sheet one to spec sheet two and say, well, this one has 10 megapixels. This one has 20 megapixels. This one is clearly better because it's got 20 mm-hmm. megapixels and, you know, and things of that nature. Or they'll go along the lines of, you know what, this one costs more, so it's probably going to be better because it costs more. So they just throw money at the problem and assuming that the more money they spend, the better their images are going to look. And Mr. Right. Laporte has, he has gone down that road a time or two. But we both laugh about it. You know, he has the A7R Mark IV, and he's still learning how to use that mighty fine camera. But, you know, again, just like you said, you can't really chase the specs because it doesn't always work out. You have to, heck, just start with the fundamentals first and figure yeah. out how to go from using the box with a hole in it before you start getting into mirrors and mirrorless and things of that nature.
I saw a tweet yesterday, I think, and it took all that I had not to chime in on it, but it was like somebody had liked this tweet from someone, so it showed up in my Twitter timeline.
Right.
And it was somebody saying, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was somebody complaining like, why are cameras so expensive nowadays? I'm never going to be able to afford anything good. And I'm like, the first thing that popped into my head was like, okay, when I first – I started on the original Canon Rebel, which I think was 6 megapixels. Uh-huh. It was really expensive at the time. Yeah. But, like, I learned everything, not most everything, on that camera. And you could probably snag it for, like, $125 now. Like, right. But people are caught up in that mentality that they have to have the latest and greatest in order to be good, when inevitably you need to start somewhere. And it doesn't matter where, because right. you're going to suck at first.
Exactly. Right? It's just going to be horrible. Go ahead and get used to it for the interim anyway.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you on that. You know, with me, I had a Sony point and shoot. I can't remember what it was called. It was one of the early Sony point and shoots, and I barely used it. But the smartphone I had at the time back then was the Motorola Droid X.
I remember that one. Yep.
And that was the one that got me serious about shooting photography. And I would shoot with that thing more than I would shoot with my point and shoot. And then I eventually ended up getting an old Rebel, which I still have that Rebel, and I love that thing. It's granted, it's tiny in my hands, but I still just have this whole emotional connection to it,
yeah.
if you will.
Well, you know what's funny? You brought that up. That Sony, I had a Sony CyberShot something or other from way back in the day. But like even before that, I remember when it wasn't even smartphones yet. I had a candy bar. Remember when Sony was Sony Ericsson with their phones?
Uh-huh.
And I had a candy bar phone that like looked like a camera on the back.
Uh-huh.
And I remember me and my friends would shoot skate videos, and I'd shoot, you know, probably like 1.3 megapixel pictures on that thing.
Man.
But that's kind of what really started me down the path. Yeah, super high quality.
Oh, man. Yeah, and I wish people would sort of take that approach more often than just trying to go out and throw money at things. If people are in our Twit community, our online forums, that's twit.community. And I know I've gotten a gazillion questions of what camera I should buy, what camera I should buy, what camera I should buy. And the first thing I ask them is, do you have a smartphone? Mm-hmm. And 98% of the time they say yes. And I say, well, don't buy a camera just yet. Just go use the phone. Get yourself used to, you know, understanding how to frame things up and tapping on the screen to get a focal point and things of that nature. And when you figure that out, once you go to pick up a, you know, camera body, that stuff will start to click a little bit better. It'll start to make a little bit more sense far as figuring out focus and exposure and things of that nature, you know. But we'll see. That's why people like you and me are here, to help spread that cheer and spread that word of, hey, let's just work with what you got. And then build your way up. Don't fall into the trap of overspending and things of that nature. Yeah, shiny tech is nice. I ain't gonna lie. I have my techno lust every now and then. But, you know, still, use what you got, you know?
It's an easier pill to swallow when you have a really inexpensive camera and you take a crappy picture with it than when you get a really expensive camera and you look at your crappy pictures and you're like, well, wait, what's going on here?
Now, that's perspective right there. That's perspective right there. I used to run a smartphone photographers community, and there was a particular member in that community that always talked about shooting this and shooting that with this camera, with this body. And every single week in that community, when we went to do our critiques, we're like, dude, you got all of this gear, but you're still not knocking out the fundamentals. You just spent $5,000 for no reason, and you're expecting to get a great shot, you know. And they finally got the picture. But, that was a nice little pun there, Ant.
Dad jokes.
I amuse myself sometimes. All right, we're going to move right along here. Google Pixel. Now, I have the Google Pixel. I actually had the first couple of Google Pixels, and now I have the Pixel XL 4. And when that phone came out, I was first to say, hey, this thing costs too daggum much. But I say that about all the phones anyway. It costs too daggum much. But what Google was touting was the photography side of it. You know, when they did their keynote, they had Miss Annie Leibovitz out there and talking about her prowess with it and going out and doing shoots and getting these amazing results and so on and so forth. And they said, hey, this is the camera that photographers can use and really get some good stuff. So, you know, good old twit.tv hooked me up and got me a Pixel XL 4. And I like the phone. I like the camera. But again, it still takes a little bit of work. Google decided to put out a little explainer about the whole night photography and astrophotography feature that's built into these phones. And I think a lot of people were confused by it. It still has its bugs here and there. I recently tried to use it on a shoot. I think it was last week. We went down to Point Reyes here in California. Beautiful, super duper dark night. No lights. You can't see squat out there. It was a perfect night for Astro. And I know you shoot a lot of Astro, and I'm pretty sure you have some great tips for that. But I pulled out my DSLR and I pulled out the Pixel, and what's supposed to happen is the AI knows that you're getting ready to do astrophotography. As long as you have it mounted on a tripod and it's sitting still, you point it up to the sky, the AI automatically kicks in and says, huh, you're shooting astro, so let me go ahead and set the camera up for you. And you just tap the button. Well, I tapped the button and nothing happens. It was just sort of in and out. It would either go to the night sight mode, which is just AI adding more light to the scene, and then every now and then it'd flip over to the astro mode. And I found I would get better results using an additional camera app called Manual Camera, where I can actually go in and control the shutter speed. And so Google was trying to explain in this article of theirs that, hey, we know we're not doing shutter speed control and ISO control. We're doing all of this stuff from a computational standpoint. With regard to computational standpoint, how do you feel with it going forward for prosumers or enthusiasts and hobbyists and what have you? I know you recently had a gentleman on your podcast, We the Creators, and you talked about the computational photography just a touch. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah, we had a great conversation about it because I'm more in like the camera industry. Mm-hmm. That's always, and I have another podcast episode coming up where I talk about, there's something about holding a camera where it like kicks me into intentionality mode, where when I'm just using a phone, it's like all the compositional skills and everything go out the window. And I look at my shots and I'm like, why didn't I even straighten the horizon line? It's a little things. Yeah. It's a mental thing between me and, but anyway, so yeah, when I talked to David Amell on my, my podcast, he's actually a tech journalist. And he had a lot of insight into the Pixel and computational photography and how they're even, I mean, I didn't know down to their like pinpointing GPS where you are on Earth, and then taking all these exposures and adjusting for the rotation of the Earth. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. The amount of algorithm
of
and tech
into it.
It's nuts.
A few seconds.
Yeah. So for me, looking at it from a camera manufacturer photography market standpoint, it's just always so interesting to me how separate the two worlds are. Uh-huh. And I think there's going to be a convergence like down the road. I don't know how soon that's going to be, but even with Fujifilm announcing the X Pro 3, mm-hmm. there's a lot of like HDR features that kind of irk into that computational photography realm. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I look at something like a process as old as photography that really is, I mean, technology is advancing, obviously, but the process is largely unchanged and has been for hundreds of years.
Right.
But with all this computational stuff that you couldn't do on an actual camera, that just excites me to what the future of creativity and photography looks like.
Oh, man. You know, and that's the beauty of this. It's like you said, the process is still the same, period. and that's never going to change. And I do love that about this particular art. I'm sort of, you know, hit or miss with it from a computational side. I get it as far as allowing just regular folks to go out there and just pick up the phone and just hit the button, mm-hmm. and they have a much nicer looking shot. And, you know, Samsung does a good job of making things cutesy and bubbly for just quote unquote regular people to do pretty nice photography. And there's a market for that. They're clearly killing it. So have at it. But me, I'd much rather have more control. I'd much rather install stuff like that manual camera app and dial in the settings myself and just get this stuff done. But what I do wish these smartphone manufacturers would do is tell you that you need some nice equipment if you want to get better results. You need nicer equipment. You need better technique. When Google had its little keynote and they had Miss Annie Leibovitz up there doing her National Geographic type photography, what they didn't mention was the fact that she was holding a rig to help steady the camera so she gets a much more crispy shot. You know, they don't mention little things like that, and it pops up really quick on the screen and goes away. Nor did they mention that she also had a couple soft boxes like what we have here in the studio to light her subject. And those little details make a difference. And if you're trying to create on that level, you need to take that amount of detail into effect with how you're going to process this. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we'll see. I doubt they'll ever do that. But that was just my rant to these manufacturers, and they're not going to pay me any attention. So never mind. All right. So I got some news that's just a little bit near and dear to your heart, Mr. Capture One. Mr. I have a photo that loads up on the Capture One software splash screen. You know, hey. Well, this week, Capture One announced their new updated version of their software. It's gone from Capture One 12 to Capture One 20. For mm-hmm. those of you that don't know, Capture One is, the best way to put it, is Adobe Lightroom's biggest competitor. Right? Is that fair enough to say?
Fair enough, yeah.
Okay. I'm an Adobe user, and I've been an Adobe fanboy forever, and that's pretty much on record everywhere you look. But I did try Capture One, and I remember I tried Capture One a couple years ago because I had a shoot to do, and I needed to tether. And Lightroom's tethering was so craptastic. Oh my gosh, it was so craptastic. But I knew I needed to tether for this particular gig, so I went ahead and installed Capture One, and man, it was light years ahead mm-hmm. from a performance standpoint. Now, far as going through and doing my actual post-processing and things like that, I still was more used to Lightroom. So I just sort of bounced back and forth. Mm-hmm. Now, I recently tried to get back into Capture One, a few weeks ago. Maybe it's been about a month now. Tried to get back into Capture One. And then I get the news of this update, and it scared me because I'm thinking, please don't change this app up too much because I'm just getting used to this. What this update included is some additional performance increases to give you a little more pep in your step when you're going through the different sliders. The UI is a little bit better. You can get some actual pop-up menus and hints and things as you hover over things. That's really helpful because some things I did not know. And mm-hmm. you still have the ability to move around the different panels to make it work and fit for your particular workflow. I'm pretty sure you got this update already installed. I just got the update installed this morning. I thought I installed mm-hmm. it yesterday, but apparently I didn't reboot, so it wasn't ready until this morning. I'm pretty sure you already got it up and running. What's your thoughts with this new update?
Yeah, I've been running the beta, since it's been available. I like it a lot. It's the things that they have done with this release are going to be more noticeable for people switching from Lightroom. Like mm-hmm. they're making it, you know, like you said, the UI changes and things like that, having like names on icons now, things, you know, of that nature. And then even they changed up their color editor, the simple color editor, to make it more like the HSL panel in Lightroom.
Right.
And so I think the biggest thing is they're seeing an influx of people coming from Lightroom, and they have the workspace where you can go up to your workspaces and change it to migration, which reorganizes things and it makes it more similar to the overall like layout of Lightroom mm-hmm. For people transitioning. Mm-hmm. And I think they're just going even further to help under the like behind the scenes, the rendering, at least for me, and especially as it pertains to X-Trans Fujifilm files,
right.
Adobe's never gotten it right.
Right.
It's pretty bad when it comes down to like the details. I can't use the built-in camera raw Lightroom sharpening or noise reduction. It just does not work. It doesn't work as it should. I'll just put it that way. So with Capture One,
from pretty much day one on the Adobe side, they haven't denied that. It's a known issue.
Yep. And their one, I think it was last year, their fix was releasing the enhanced details where you can open, you know, a raw file, a click enhanced details, and it's going to take that raw file, interpolate a bunch of stuff, and then spit you out a DNG file that's supposed to be more detailed, but it takes one file takes, you know, a couple minutes depending on your computer. So it's not really a solution. It's more they don't care. They just don't care. Yeah. You know, they're like a money making machine, and they're doing fine. So they don't really need to focus on what they would consider this smaller segment of the market, I think.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's how it always goes in the big companies, mm-hmm. you know.
Yep.
I'm going to continue to play around with Capture One. I can't say I'm going to totally drop Adobe because of my particular workflow. My workflow starts out, all right, I grab my raw files, pull them into Lightroom. I don't even use Bridge. A lot of people use Bridge. Pull it into Lightroom, do whatever I need to do there. And if I need to, I use the dynamic link and send it from Lightroom to Photoshop if there's some other manipulation that I need to do.
Yeah.
And it's all simply done with the click. And I can continue on with Camera Raw from there and then hop right back into Lightroom still with just a few clicks. So it's a workflow that just works for me. I'm not knocking Capture One. Like I said, I still would probably use it in here in the future, but if there's a couple of times where I know I need to do some manipulation, have to have that particular link to Photoshop pretty quickly, that's the route I'll go. But yeah.
I'll throw this hat into the ring. Mm-hmm. So I'm the same. So I'll never be able to abandon Adobe completely because I'm a graphic designer, right?
Right.
I need Photoshop. I need that Illustrator. I need those applications. And even when I'm using Capture One as my raw processor, I'm still exporting. I actually have an export process. Capture One has this a tab called Processes where you can set, you know, if you're exporting to a website or Instagram or Twitter, right, and you want to have different settings and right, different file types exported. So I have an export process that just exports to a PSD. And then opens it, like you can check to open automatically in Photoshop. So I hit one button and then it opens up in Photoshop.
That's beautiful.
So there are little workarounds that you can do to kind of emulate your old workflow. But yes, of course, it's always going to be easier in the native Adobe applications because they're kind of made to talk to each other.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good. I have to look into that, and I guess I'm going to have to go out and find some of your tutorials or something. I'm sure you got something out there about that. Maybe I have to call you up. Hey, I need some help, Brian.
I love to. I love doing that stuff for people. Honestly, it's highlights of my day are when I get to help other people out. But I will – Capture One has an amazing tutorial presence on their blog, and they explain a ton of this stuff. I even – the other day I was trying to figure out how to do something, and I even had to like revert to one of their tutorials, and it just blew my world open because I didn't realize that I could do something that I didn't think I could.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm going to keep playing around with it here. Heck, the main thing is I need to start shooting more. I haven't had much time to shoot, but I have been able to start back shooting a little bit more regularly. So that's going to be a big help, at least with that part of it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So before we get out of here, I want to dig a little bit more into you. I want to dig into Brian Manier. Who is he?
Sure.
What's he doing? And what's he got going on? If anybody were to look you up and pull up your website, the first thing they're going to see is those magical colors from your Fujifilm camera. Oh gosh, it's beautiful. I'm not going front. It's flat out beautiful.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that.
But they're also going to see that you're not just a photographer, but you're a graphic designer. Mm-hmm. Now, Wools and I, previously we've talked about it, that I think it's a great idea to have a relationship with a graphics designer. Mm-hmm. If you're a photographer, heck, even if you're a videographer, because graphic designers, you folks see things just a little bit differently from an aesthetic standpoint. And of course from design, but from aesthetic, and a lot of times it can help make your shot a little bit better. If you can understand the proper framing, understand the proper color temperature to use for this particular time and things of that nature. And a lot of times the graphic designers, they just get it. So you are wearing both hats. You're in Illustrator, but you're also out there getting up today to go do sunrise photos and watch the deer run in front of you. You know, so tell me a little bit more about your graphic design background. What made you decide to get into graphic design? Did you get into graphic design first and then photography? Was it vice versa? Or how does that go?
It was design first. And to be honest, I mean, I've been fiddling with a camera since I had cameras around. I remember having old access to like old Polaroid cameras as a kid, and I would play around with them.
Oh, man, and the ones my where you had to shake them.
Yep, exactly. Which actually, in retrospect, did nothing. You didn't have to shake them. It was just something that everybody did. But yeah, so the idea of just capturing moments always intrigued me, even though I didn't really understand it was an art form.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was going through high school and trying to figure out what I was going to do, I was actually being looked at to play football for – I was having scouts come out and look at me at, to be a student athlete in college. I was a running back, and I had an incident when I was a junior in high school where I got this crazy autoimmune disease. I lost like 50 pounds and all my muscle mass. I was in the hospital for 4 months. It was this crazy thing. We won't dive too far into that. All of that to say, when I came back and played my senior year, I wasn't quite as where I should have been, you know, in order to progress down that path. So I started kind of looking at what I wanted to do. Luckily enough, I had an art teacher in high school that was like, well, you should look at the school that I went to because they have an art program and they're actually starting a graphic design program. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what that was, but I knew I had pirated Photoshop as a kid because I couldn't afford it, and tinkered around in Photoshop. And so I kind of thought, well, I know I like art and I know I love computers, so graphic design seems like the perfect kind of intersection of the two. And so that's how it started for me. You know, the semester that I started the design program at my school was one semester old. So I started in pretty early. The professor that taught it was actually a printmaker that had some experience with like Photoshop and stuff just from screen printing and stuff like that. So it was a pretty young program, which meant that we could kind of make it whatever we wanted to. We were encouraged to create a business presence and find our own clients. So pretty early on, I was playing music too. I'm also a guitar player. So I found my way doing designs for bands for like MySpace. I taught myself to code with MySpace layouts and stuff like that. And so photography came in when I'm at college and I can take a photography class as just part of my art curriculum. And so when I got in the dark room, that's when I really started falling in love with just the overall process. I didn't fully understand it, but the process is what got me, you know, printing, watching an image come up in the developer and then being able to print it on an enlarger. It was just something that I never forgot. And then our design lab actually acquired the Canon Rebels that I was talking about earlier, that we could have access to and check in and out. And so I started using them to supplement my design work. I'd take high res, 6 megapixel,
right.
high res textures, you know, of dirt or a torn piece of paper or whatever to supplement the design stuff. And that's kind of how I always saw it. And then bands started being interested in me taking their photos for their layouts. And I found strobus.com and David Hobby stuff and taught myself off camera lighting. And then a friend asked me to do a wedding. And then I just was, just kind of thrusted into this whole world of photography.
Oh, they asked you to do a wedding? Oh man.
Yeah, that was, I did it. The photos were good enough. They were happy with them.
Good.
But I didn't shoot another wedding for 3 or 4 years. I second shot for another photographer until I felt I got to a point where I was, you know, capable of shooting a wedding.
Right. Now that's smart. Yeah. That's smart. The ego didn't get in the way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's up. Now, from a graphic design standpoint, what would be your favorite route of going? I know a couple of graphic designers, and some of them, they love doing logos. They love doing, you know, marks and brands for different people or different companies. And then you have others that love to do a lot of sort of off-the-wall conceptual designs. Making scenes and things of that nature. What's your niche? What's your favorite?
My favorite thing to do is definitely branding, designing logos. I love Adobe Illustrator. But the stuff that I tend to do more is the layout stuff, laying out catalogs in InDesign, I do a lot of digital ads, things like that. But I've come from a point of doing a lot of different print design and identity and logo and branding stuff. That's where if I was just going to be a freelance designer, I would go down the route of probably like a branding designer. But I'm the kind of guy that I'm very interested in everything. And I'm lucky to work right now with a couple motion graphics designers.
Ooh.
And, you know, working
in
skill. In After Effects and stuff like that, and doing animation and 3D rendering and Cinema 4D. And I've tinkered in some of that stuff.
Yeah.
But man, that if I could pick anything, I think it would be going more and more down that path, because it's very, I think there, I don't know, there's just something about the complexity of it all. I mean, I look at what I've been doing for the past 12, 15 years or whatever it's been, where I've mainly been a 2D designer in Photoshop. The idea of going down a 3D and motion path is like really exciting to me in a weird way. So, yeah, I think that probably is about as good as I can answer that question.
Well, with that said, have you considered looking also at Adobe Dimension?
No, I don't even know what that is.
Well, that is part of, well, they actually have a couple of products. They have Project Aero, and they also have Adobe Dimension. Dimension is a 3D rendering application where you can build, you know, objects, if you will, and place them into your scenes, whether it's placing them into a photograph or placing them into something that you've drawn up in Photoshop or Illustrator, and just gives you more of a 3D workspace.
I'll have to check it out. And it's like their Cinema 4D, essentially.
Well, no, it's not. It's not more on the video side. It's more on the graphical, graphic side, print side, if you will.
Got it.
It's fairly intuitive. I've played around with it a couple times. There's one image that comes to my mind. I took a stock shot for a local coffee house back home in Carolina, and they needed a bag of coffee to be shown in the scene. And I was able to go and grab a design inside of Dimension and place their label on it and mold it to fit to the bag and put some depth in the bag and shadows and all of that and drop it into that photograph. And you would never know that was a CGI coffee bag in that photo, but it just flat out works. There's that. And then they also have Aero. It's more on the augmented reality side, but again, you get to render 3D objects and things of that nature, and all of that stuff's included in the Creative Cloud.
Yeah. So while you were talking, I just went and installed Dimension. So see? I'll play around with that later today.
It's pretty slick.
One more thing I'll add, back to what you were saying about when you were first talking about just design and photography and kind of the intersection of the two. I think, and I talk about this a lot on my podcast, and it's the reason I started a podcast, really, because I love the idea of, I mean, inevitably, all of us as artists, we do multiple things.
Yep.
And I think
if you want to get paid, you have to.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But like a lot of times we don't think about those relationships between things. So I never really thought how my design skills were influencing my photography, or vice versa, until one day it just kind of it dawned on me, because people would comment on my composition or would comment on my color palettes. And I was like, there's got to be a relationship to, you know, what I'm doing in photography that just comes from. And I think, like you said, compositionally, when it comes to, because I take great pride in the color editing that I do with my photos. And a lot of that just stems from that kind of layout design knowledge, where I'm thinking in terms of not just thinking like photographically in terms of the scene and the light, but also just everything's placement within a scene. And I think, yeah, those two things for me, like I wouldn't be the photographer that I am without my my design past, for sure.
Yeah, I can totally dig that, because I know when I see one of your images, when I'm scrolling through my social media, Instagram in particular, and I'm just, you know, just flipping the thumb. But when one of those pop up, I don't even have to look. I know, oh, that's Brian's.
Well, that's honestly the greatest compliment that I could ever get. So I appreciate that for sure.
My pleasure. Now, with the photography side, you know, you've mentioned that, hey, I'm a Fuji ambassador. Well, yep, you definitely are. How in the world did that come about, my man?
I think it was, I have a blog post on my site that really goes in depth and details everything, but the short of the long is I was almost right place, right time with everything. I picked up my first Fujifilm camera was the original X100.
Okay.
Back, I saw it at Photokina. I think it was Photokina 2011. And then I think the camera came out around the early 2012. And I was just in love at first sight. Didn't even care about the specs. There was something about the camera that I was just like, I'm so sick of carrying my 5Ds around everywhere. Like, I just want that thing. And it's funny. That's what everybody says that is now, that now shoots Fujifilm mostly. So it's not like a unique answer. But so I started with the cameras early on and grew a knowledge of them. They, even through when I was still shooting Canon, my backup when I was shooting weddings was always like an X-Pro1 or an X-T1 until finally I felt I was at a point where I could just throw the full-frame Canons away altogether and switch. Mm-hmm. But like I said, equal parts luck and just me kind of finding the brand early on. Mm-hmm. When I started Instagram in like 2014, 2015. I never knew what to tag my shots because the only Fuji account, like local, was Fujifilm North America.
Right.
So I would tag Fujifilm North America. Come to find out, that's actually Canada's account. Canada runs the North America account.
Oh, well, it is North America.
Yeah, but there was no Fujifilm US.
Right.
So I think it was August of 2015. No, August of, it doesn't matter. 2014 or 2015, they started their Fujifilm XUS channels on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Right.
I was just excited to have like a hub and meet other Fujifilm shooters.
Right.
So I started tagging my shots. Yeah, exactly. So I just started tagging my shots, hashtagging, and it was maybe a week and a half later, I had an email from somebody at Fujifilm North America, and I was like, it was just like a hello from the mothership type thing, and she wanted to, you know, hear my background, and so I gave her the whole spiel of everything, and we started working together in a small capacity, just mm-hmm. like, hey, we have a need for a print ad. Could we use this image, and we'll send you this lens as payment? And, you know, me, I'm just like, heck yes, awesome gear. Chug. But yeah, so that's kind of how the relationship grew. I don't know what they saw in me, because when I look back to my images at the time, it was but thankfully they saw a potential in me, I think, because they looked to a lot of their ambassadors from an educational standpoint, and I'm just a nerd when it comes to the tech side of photography, so I know the cameras inside and out. And so I think they saw that partnered with my consistency at always being out shooting, like you said. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always looking for something else, even though I'm in Michigan and we don't have the best locations, the most scenic locations here.
Right.
I'm always trying to find something. And I think so those two things led maybe 9-10 months from when I first started working with them for them asking me to be an ambassador. So.
That's awesome. And the key thing there that I got out of this is you were just doing what you love. You were just shooting because you loved to shoot, and the opportunity presented itself.
It's so weird. Sorry to interrupt. It's so weird to me now looking back on it, because I was never aware of like the photo industry.
Uh-huh.
I was just a photographer that shot, you know, and I didn't go to Photo Plus Expo and I didn't do this and that, and that didn't go to dealer events and stuff like that. I didn't even think being a brand ambassador was like a possibility. It wasn't even a blip on my radar, mm-hmm. you know? So, but yeah, just it's hindsight being what it is. Like, it's weird to think back to how oblivious I was to everything. And yet somehow I managed to get to where I am.
Now, let me ask you this, because on another one of your episodes, you talked a little bit about personal branding. Now, let's go back in time, because hindsight is always 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do differently in 2015?
Oh, that's a great question. I think 2015 was kind of my creative renaissance year. It's when I abandoned like all of the stuff that didn't bring me joy in photography, mm-hmm. wedding, not fully weddings, but like the wedding grind. I abandoned that. I abandoned senior portraits. I abandoned like all of that stuff. I was like, nope, I'll shoot maybe 5 weddings a year and I'll be a landscape photographer and I'm just going to enjoy myself, find a full-time design job, and photography is just going to be fun.
Right.
From that aspect of it, I regret nothing, and I wouldn't change a thing. But I will say this, and this is a conversation I had that will air in a couple weeks, just a couple days ago with a friend. I think one of the biggest things that I have neglected to build is now I find myself in this position where I see a future where I start freelancing again. But a lot of those pathways that I would have had to potential clients, I just cold turkey stopped. And so, whereas if I kept a few things around, trickling, did things here or there, I might have an easier road back into what I'm doing, what I would like to do.
Right.
So I think that's probably the biggest thing. And then on top of that, I think I'm pretty, if you look at my social media presence, I'm pretty location agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't even know that I'm in Michigan.
Right.
They have to ask, because it's not really something I brought. I'm not from here, so I'm not particularly proud of like where I'm from. Yeah.
I had to dig, and we have a mutual friend, Mr. Dave Zwiduk. I actually got it from him too. So
okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not something I try to intentionally hide.
Uh-huh.
It's just, I'm not like a lot of people that are from Michigan are very like pro Michigan people. And I don't care. So it's not something that I like try. I don't want to be a fake person and say, yeah, I'm a Michigander, because I'm really not, even though I've lived here for 5 years, 6 years now. So I think that's a big thing, because I see a lot of my friends who kind of are these Michigan based photographers.
Mm-hmm.
They get a lot more of the cool, like City of Lansing gigs or
right.
City of Detroit gigs, that sort of stuff, where I'm not even on the list, because I'm just people will look at my feed and they're like, well, he's not even remotely
right.
close to here. You know what
right.
I mean? So I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've learned is, you know, even though my switch and the road that I took, I probably wouldn't change anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if there's anything that I've learned, it's, you kind of still have to prepare for a little bit of a future, in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Have a broader view, if you will.
Yes. Yeah.
I totally get it. You said something previously about not being in the cool locations, if you will. And I appreciate the fact that you still get up and you just go shoot regardless of where you are. Personally, I had a series at one point in time where I tried to tell my friends and followers that if you want to get into photography, go outside of your back door. Just go out into your backyard and shoot whatever it is out there. It was a little bit easy for me to say, because my backyard in Carolina, I would walk out and see, you know,
Blue Ridge Mountains,
deer and
and
it's just, you know, I had a whole lot to look at. But still, I wanted people to understand it. You could just go out in your backyard and just go look at a shrub or something. There's probably a bee hovering around a shrub. See if you can work on your panning skills and fix that shutter speed to capture that bee buzzing around. You know, just little stuff like that. So it's not always about trying to go and get that outstanding cityscape and things of that nature. You know, just go outside your back door. I really appreciate you hinting to that there. All right.
I think if I can add one thing to that, one tiny thing.
Go ahead.
Is I love that in that sentiment, because if you can succeed in that in your backyard, if you can get cool shots where there really aren't many cool shots to be found, then you can go to some place like Yosemite and you're going to be looking. You're not just going to shoot the you know, the tunnel view shot that everyone gets. I mean, sure, you'll shoot that because it's epic, but you're going to be looking for those little details, and you're going to be a far better, your eye is going to be far better and more developed because you took the time than if you just, you know, lived in Colorado and just drove around taking epic shots because you can, because it's everywhere, you know?
Yeah. Like it's nothing.
Yeah.
I totally get it. All right. Before we get out of here, there's one more thing I want to give you grief about. And it's on your Twitter feed. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And you put together an outstanding holiday card, man. Holy crap. Because part of your bio. Okay, so yes, Fujifilm, check. Graphic designer, check. Photographer, check. Star Wars fan, big old check. Okay.
Yep.
This holiday card that you put together, it is reminiscent of the 1977 Star Wars movie poster, but this is of you and your family. And the amount of detail that you have on this just really, really, really blows me away. So I'm going to put this in our show notes so people can go and check it out and go over there and get that give you a little like signal. So hopefully Mr. Mark Hamill himself will finally hop on over and give you your cred, man. This is outstanding. So what brought this about? Is this something that you do every year for the holiday season? Or
yeah. So ever since my wife and I got married, we've done just weird cards, and they've progressively gotten better. And it's kind of almost like the first year was just us dressed up as Santa and Mrs. Claus. Then the second year was us, like, she was like Betty Homemaker with a plate of cookies. And I had like, you can see I have long hair. I'm kind of a grungy guy. I had like slicked over hair, you know, kind of reminiscent of Cousin Eddie from Christmas Vacation. Third year we did awkward family Christmas, where I had my hair parted down the middle and glasses, and like my eyes were closed in half of the pictures. And our cats even showed up in like floating heads in the background. And then I recreated a Christmas Story movie cover, and then we would alternate and not do a movie the next year. And then the next year we would do a movie, and then the next year not. And then that brings us to this year. And it's the only difference this year to years of past is like we've recreated the Home Alone cover with my son, the Christmas Story cover. That was before he was born. Uh-huh. Those are the only two movie ones we've done. So this one isn't Christmas related at all. And I thought about having my son wear a Santa Claus hat at least.
Right.
But I was just like, nah, I'm just going to go for broke and do the full Star Wars. I honestly, when I first came up with the concept, I was like, I know I can shoot the photos. I know I can get the lighting close and match the lighting. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea if I can. A lot of people thought that I just took like our pictures and superimposed them in the poster. But I actually started from scratch. Hand painted in all the watercolor effects, all the lighting effects, all the ships that are in there, and the droids are 3D renders from pixelsquid.com that I had to like position properly. And then I went in and like painted in flames for the rear. Yeah. So it was all from, it was probably like 15 or so hours in Photoshop, but I'm very pleased with how it came out as just a Star Wars nerd that gets to share that love with people, you know?
It is so well done. And what I'm going to try to describe it again, this is, if you think back to the 1977 Star Wars poster, it is pretty much a spitting image of that. We have Mr. Meneer as Han off to the left of the frame with a blaster. And then his son is front and center as Luke.
He's a good Luke. What really bums me out, though, about that? Uh-huh. The only thing that bums me out at all about the whole card is that he has, for the entirety of his life, he has had beautiful, blonde, long, shaggy hair.
Okay.
And about a month ago, my wife decided to cut it off, much to my chagrin.
Oh, man. It
would have been the perfect. I don't know if we can do this. A poor representation of it, but
they could see
that gives you an idea.
It's
of what it looks like.
It's beautiful. And then your wife is off to the right of the frame as Leia with the awesome hair, and she's got a blaster. And there's the cat is Chewy.
Mewbacca. That's Mewbacca.
Mewbacca. That is so well done. So well done, man. All right. Well, Mr. Meneer, brother, thank you so much for hanging out with me today here on Focus on Photography. I was excited to get you on because I love your background and I love your passion. I watch you on the social media. You are, you know, to be as popular and big as you are just a regular guy just out there enjoying creating content, man. And you share your knowledge and you converse with people pretty openly. It's great to see that in this world of influencers.
That's a four-letter word for me.
Yeah. Right. It's great to see that, but I appreciate you hopping on and joining us this week. Is there anything that you would like to plug? You know, where exactly can we find you and your work?
I'm at brianmeneer.com. That's BrianMineer. Twitter is Brian Meneer. Instagram is Brian Meneer. That's where I hang out the most. And then you can find me at WeTheCreatorsPod.com. That's my podcast where I talk to a lot of cool creators about what they're into and their struggles and all that stuff. That's my new fun thing. So, yeah.
Outstanding. All right, folks. Well, thank you again to all of the folks that are listening to Focus on Photography here on twit.tv. Thank you again to our live chat room that's been hanging out and talking and just chilling with us this morning. Find us each and every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time as we go on air to record this show. And the main thing, though, is to go ahead and open up your favorite podcatcher of choice, search for Focus on Photography, and hit the subscribe button, and you'll get the automatically beautiful post process showing up in your feeds each and every Thursday. Shout out to my wonderful team of technical directors and engineers here at the studio, making me sound and look good on the mics and on the camera. And also be sure to check out our Twit online forums. That is twit.community in your browsers. Hop in there and you can chat with me and the other host and Mr. Laporte. Regardless of the show, we have channels for the different shows. We have very random topics. And it gets interesting in there, some of the conversations we have. It's a bunch of good old nerdy fun. And also, don't forget to follow Twit on the social medias. That is twit.tv on Instagram, as well as at Twit on Twitter. If you follow us on Instagram, you're going to see some pretty interesting stuff from behind the scenes. Our social media team, they can be quite crafty at times, and you never know what you're going to see going on behind the scenes in the studio. All right. Thank you again for all the continued support. We'll catch you guys on the next episode of Focus on Photography next week. So go ahead and stay tuned. Thank you again, folks. Get out there, create, dominate. We'll see you.